For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
I'm Taigen, Dharma teacher here at Ancient Dragons and Gate, but I'm very happy to have giving a talk this morning, Reverend Aishin Nancy Easton, who is our Tenzo, head of our kitchen, also practice leader and a member of the board, and one of the founders of Ancient Dragons and Gate. There are several others in the room. So thank you very much for giving the talk this morning, Aishin.
Oh, thank you for asking me. And I didn't know this when I agreed to give the talk, but I kind of thought that I wanted to talk about bodhisattvas today. And I had been thinking that. And then last week, Taigen, it happened to be Parinirvana Day, and so Taigen was talking about the Buddhas passing away into Nirvana and his inconceivable lifespan, and one of the things that the Buddha says in the Lotus Sutra about, who will carry my teaching forward into this, the future evil age that's coming, and the ways in which bodhisattvas sprang up from the earth to say, we're here, we'll do it. And so I think Buddha was very encouraged by that. And so I want to talk a little bit about just the concept of what a bodhisattva is, and then some of the major sort of bodhisattva figures in historical Mahayana Buddhism, and then a little bit about the qualities of bodhisattvas and how that manifests in our world today. So I want to start off by just sort of refreshing our memory of bodhisattvas and how bodhisattvas are really, really the hallmark of the difference between the Theravada and Mahayana schools, or one of the aspects of the hallmark between those two schools. In Theravada Buddhism, we have the kind of, actually, I should say that one of the central teachings common to any school of Buddhism is that of the Four Noble Truths. That the first noble truth, that there is suffering, that suffering there's a cause to suffering which comes out of our own grasping and craving and, greed, hatred, ignorance, and the third noble truth, that there is a way that the suffering can end, and the fourth noble truth, that there is a path to the end of suffering. And in Theravada Buddhism, they emphasize more how an individual might go through that path of, and working with suffering, ending suffering in one's own life, and so. Kind of the idealized figure within Theravada Buddhism is the arhat, which is the practitioner who has worked to really extinguish craving in their life, and they are they are entering into nirvana or will enter into nirvana, and it's very much a focus on individual liberation and individually working with that in their life, and The contrast is within the Mahayana Buddhist school, which is what our Sangha and temple is part of. The contrasting figure is the Bodhisattva, and literally, Bodhisattva, Sanskrit for Bodhi is wisdom, and Sattva is being. And so a Bodhisattva is a wisdom being who, basically, the vow of the Bodhisattva is to stay within the world until they are able, and not pass into Nirvana until they are able to help everyone else to do so. And so the Bodhisattva agrees to keep coming back and, you know, engaging in the suffering of the world. At the same time, you know, I think sometimes when I think about that in my life, I'm like, oh, you know, I'm not sure I'm up for that, really. You know, that just sounds like a lot of, like, suffering, and I'm kind of tired. I would like this to end. But you know, you also come back for the joy of the world and for really all of the experiences of the world. And so it's not so much extinguishing craving in one's own life and extinguishing it in others, but learning to peacefully abide with that suffering so that you can continue to be part of it. You know, we in practice, I think we reflect on, you know, the ways in which, all the different ways in which we can suffer and ways in which we can experience joy or experience, you know, things that we want to hold on to, and we just work with those. And I think the agreement of the Bodhisattva is to just continue to work with those and not, you know, aim towards sort of the end, but just to allow it to come on. So recognizing that joy is going to pass, as, you know, as an experience, and suffering is going to pass, and all of those experiences come out of our relationship with our own, you know, greed or grasping, or hatred or aversion or ignorance or delusion. And so, you know, Bodhisattvas come back to share the suffering and the joy of life in this world over and over and over again. And in different ways, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about the ways that Bodhisattvas are depicted in, you know, sutras and sort of traditional Mahayana literature is that they are, each of the major Bodhisattva figures expresses a particular quality in the world. And I'm gonna talk a little bit about some of the major historical Bodhisattvas, and actually I brought the Bodhisattva action figures from my home altar, so I'll pass them around as well. So it's always good to spend time with your Bodhisattva action figures. But there are five major Bodhisattvas that I want to just at least touch on today. The first of which is the one that I think probably most people hear about first, which is the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, who is also known as Kanon in Japanese, or Kanzeon, or Kuan Yin in Chinese. And Avalokiteshvara, or Kanon, is the Bodhisattva of compassion. It's a Bodhisattva that is, unlike most Bodhisattvas, can be depicted as male or female or androgynous, and is such a major Bodhisattva that Kanon is depicted in many different ways. There's a picture of Kanon riding on a lotus leaf across the ocean, protecting, you know, travelers. And there's another image of the Bodhisattva of compassion pouring water, you know, in a compassionate way, that, you know, the idea is sort of that the water will extend to, you know, wherever it's needed for soothing. And so those are some traditional depictions of Kanon. But Kanon's name literally means sound hearer or cry regarder. And I'm going to read you actually a little bit of the chapter from the Lotus Sutra that talks about Kanon, so you can just get a little bit of a sense of the imagery that surrounds the power that is inherent, I think, in being able to just hear the cries of the world. Kanon is listening at all times, is depicted with many hands and eyes, and is able to listen to all of the cries of all the suffering beings. I'm going to pass around my Kuan Yin while I read this. And so chapter 15. 25, thank you, of the Lotus Sutra talks about the universal gateway of accessing Kanzeon Bodhisattva. I'm just going to read one little part of it, and it says, you know, when living beings suffer hardships, burdened by immeasurable woes, the power of Kanzeon's wondrous wisdom can relieve the suffering of the world. Fully endowed with miraculous powers, widely practicing wisdom and skillful means, in every land, in all directions, in no realm does Kanzeon not appear. In all the various evil destinies of hell beings, hungry ghosts, and animals, the sufferings of birth, old age, sickness, and death, all are gradually erased by Kanzeon, whose true regard, serene regard, far-reaching wise regard, regard with compassion and loving kindness is ever longed for, ever revered. Unblemished, serene radiance, benevolent sun dispelling all gloom, Kanzeon can subdue the wind and fire of woes, clearly illuminating all the world. The precepts of compassion roar like thunder, the kind heart is wondrous as great clouds, pouring dharma rain of sweet dew, quenching all flames of troubling passion. So that imagery kind of invokes a little bit of what I was mentioning about the water pouring Kanzeon, Kanzeon is quenching the flames of troubling passion through the power of compassionate listening. You know, I think that in all of our lives, we have times where we really are very much in touch with how fragile our own life is, how fragile the people around us are, and how much we, you know, at those times long for someone to just know, you know, that you're there and that you're in pain. I was reading an article yesterday in the New York Times about a man who was just released from prison after 45 years, most of which was spent in solitary confinement. And he talks about how he really got in touch with, you know, who he was in that time, and was able to find, you know, something within himself that got himself through that. But I think what he acknowledged, and I think you probably already know, is that for most people that is so painful, just to feel so isolated, and to feel like, you know, nobody knows you're there, nobody hears, and that's, I think, part of the power of the compassion of Kanzeon, the ability to listen and know, you know, and to try to help. You know, compassion can mean to suffer with, you know, and that's, I think, how, as Westerners, we tend to, you know, think about that word. But it also means to try to help, you know, to try to do what one, you know, reasonably can to try to help. And you know, there are some qualities that are attributed to Kanon that I'm going to talk about specifically in a little bit. But qualities that are attributed to Kanon would be things like generosity, patience, skillful means, powers, wisdom, things that you know, all of us can cultivate a little bit through our meditation practice, through sitting down and, you know, allowing ourselves to relax into, you know, some reflection on what would be the most helpful thing in a situation especially when we don't know. So Kanon or Avalokiteshvara really helps and is, you know, I think the Bodhisattva that in traditional Buddhist cultures is most well known and most relied upon. But other important bodhisattvas would include Manjushri, who sits on our altar right below Buddha, right in front of the flower bowl, the offer or the incense holder. And Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom or insight. And in some of the things that we chant or read, or, you know, sometimes you'll hear about Manjushri. Manjushri is typically, his name means noble one. He's typically depicted as an adolescent boy, so I say he, or, you know, kind of a, not an adolescent boy. The power of, you know, youth, actually, that you know, the kind of encompassing the human power of, you know, ability to do things. And Manjushri typically carries a sword that cuts through delusions and rides on a lion because, you know, that's a sort of a fierce but noble image. And Manjushri represents qualities like wisdom or prajna, ethical conduct, meditation or jhana. Manjushri is really the bodhisattva who is able to cut through our delusions. And I always find Manjushri a little bit intimidating personally, because I'm always like, oh, you know, there's always a little bit more I could probably cut through in my own life. So that's Manjushri. Another major bodhisattva is Samantabhadra, whose name means universal virtue, and Samantabhadra is the bodhisattva of enlightening activity. So, actually, you know, in our meal chant, I think we chant all of these bodhisattvas, and so we chant Samantabhadra, great activity, and Samantabhadra is represented as typically riding an elephant. As compared to riding a lion, you know, Samantabhadra is just a big force, And I think, you know, appropriate for a meal chant where we're reflecting on all the different beings that contributed to our being able to eat something and sustain our life. You know, Samantabhadra is very much representative of that force. And so, you know, Samantabhadra really represents the application of wisdom to benefit the world, and has qualities associated with him that include powers, vow, knowledge, meditation. I think of Samantabhadra as being partly related to cooperation and cooperating in beneficial activity. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more later on in this talk. But I think that that's an important and sometimes overlooked, you know, bodhisattva and aspect of our life. I want to talk about Jizo Bodhisattva, who is also a very popular bodhisattva. The Sanskrit name for Jizo Bodhisattva is Kshitagarbha, which means earth womb or storehouse. And Jizo Bodhisattva has taken a vow to go into the hell realms of life and to be with the beings there and be with them in such a way as to try to help end their suffering, help them to leave that hell realm in which they're stuck. And so Jizo Bodhisattva is venerated in Japan in particular as a protector of children or travelers, or especially children who are unborn or suffering, and very, very, well, just very revered. Jizo Bodhisattva is also kind of considered to be a guide to the afterlife or the deceased, and is sometimes related to the earth. And when we think of, you know, what I was talking about earlier, and Taigen was really talking about more last week, about the bodhisattvas coming out of the ground to say, yes, we'll be here and preach the Dharma and help. I think of Jizo. Jizo is typically depicted as sometimes sort of a childlike kind of qualities and softer kind of face, and sometimes carrying a big staff that, you know, makes noise when it hits the ground. But Jizo is also depicted as carrying a wish-fulfilling jewel, which my little Jizo does not have the staff, but he does have the wish-fulfilling jewel, so I'll send him around. And Jizo is very much associated with Vow, Great Vow Monastery in Oregon is built partly in reflection of Jizo and his great vow to save living beings even in the most difficult circumstances, more difficult than ones we typically encounter in our life. Jizo also represents ethical conduct, effort, and some of the powers that are necessary to be able to carry out that vow and that task. And then finally, I want to just mention Maitreya, who is the bodhisattva who is destined to become the next Buddha in the future evil age. If we're not there, I guess there's going to be an even more evil age in the future. And Maitreya is just waiting in Tushita heaven to become the next Buddha. But while he's waiting, he is sitting and listening and reflecting and being, you know, very much aware of and reflecting on what will be helpful in the future. And so Maitreya, you know, kind of represents in some ways our responsibility to future generations or our hopes for the future. His name means loving one. And you can, in the name Maitreya, you can hear kind of something that sounds similar to metta or loving kindness. And so that's, you know, kind of what is evoked when people talk about Maitreya. You know, he evokes the practice of just emanating good wishes to other beings, just, you know, kind of bringing that quality to interactions with other beings. And the qualities that Maitreya represents in particular would be things like patience or meditation or generosity. Maitreya just tries to do, you know, what he can to be helpful. And when people invoke the image of Maitreya, it's typically in a, you know, please come and help us move into the future. So those are some major bodhisattvas, and the thing that I really like in particular about thinking about those historical bodhisattva figures, I don't think off the top of my head that any of them are particular people. You know, sometimes I think of bodhisattvas as like saints, in that they have, you know, they represent these particular qualities or particular situations, but I don't think that any of them are particular figures. I think the Dalai Lama actually is supposed to be the current, you know, continuing incarnation of Avalokiteshvara, but I don't think that when we think of particular bodhisattvas, we think of a particular person who lived at a time. What I like, what I like about that is each one represents and embodies and depicts a particular quality that we can, you know, use in our life and study and find some way to engage with in our life. And so, so although we have these historical figures of bodhisattvas, and, you know, sometimes very literally depicted, like with my statues, it's a little bit different from that. You know, at the end of Taigen's talk last week, and as part of what, you know, Buddha is saying in the Lotus Sutra, we were talking about Buddha's inconceivable lifespan that you know, Buddha kind of reveals in the Lotus Sutra that although he appeared to pass into parinirvana, he's been alive for forever, and he's continued to go on living, and I think we were encouraged to think about how that can be. You know, how does Buddha still live? And, you know, for me, the answer is always, you know, Buddha lives as us. You know, we when we are able to, you know, remember Buddha, think about the qualities of Buddha, try to live, you know, in such a way that we manifest those qualities, Buddha lives as us. And I think, you know, that's it's really the same thing for bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas are living as us. They are living through our intentional actions, but they're also living all around us, you know, through ordinary, everyday activity. And the more we know about bodhisattvas and bodhisattva action, and the more we try to pay attention to that, the easier it is to see. And the more we, you know, the more we see bodhisattva action in the world around us, the more, for me at least, that encourages my own practice of bodhisattva activity. So even though, you know, Buddha's physical body was finite and all of our physical bodies are finite, the lifespan is still inconceivably long and inconceivably wide. I know there are some cultures in which people are not thought to have really passed away until the last person who remembered that person passes away. Mm-hmm. And I like that as thinking about Buddha, you know, that as long as someone is able to reflect on Buddha, you know, then Buddha's really still alive, you know, and bodhisattvas are also very much alive and can have agency in ways that exists far beyond what we think that we ordinarily can do. So, you know, bodhisattvas are really living through us out of our wish or intention to practice as one. So, which maybe brings me to the question of, you know, how do we do that? What are bodhisattva activities? And there are two sets of things that I think, you know, we can think about as major sources of guidance for how we might manifest bodhisattva action in our lives. One would be the paramitas, which are transcendent practices that we can engage in our life that help bring ourselves some, you know, compassion and enlightenment in our life, but help to bring that to others as well. Some traditions think that there are six paramitas, and I think there are six main paramitas, and then four additional paramitas that I think we can include that we, you know, talk about in our tradition. The paramitas would include things like generosity or giving, or in Sanskrit the word is dana. And so if you've heard people say, you know, there's a dana bowl out front, that's what they mean. It's just a bowl in which one can give, you know, an offering, something to help, you know, sustain the temple in particular. But any kind of giving is really, you know, very much a paramita. There is the paramita of ethical conduct, or shila, which would include, I think, precepts and finding ways of harnessing our activity in ways that are ethical, that are not just based on, you know, kind of what's good for us, but in a way that we, you know, try as best we can to widen our scope and try to work in such a way that is universally beneficial and adheres to, you know, laws regarding that. The third paramita would be patience or kshanti, or forbearance, or the ability to sit with, you know, all kinds of things. So we talk about, I think, you know, at different times practicing patience, and sometimes it's really a practice. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes you really have to work at it. And finding a way to just relax with a situation long enough to be able to reflect on it and you know, widen your view of it, I think can be very beneficial. The fourth paramita would be effort, or in Sanskrit that's virya, and that would be just so. Sometimes I think that, you know, Manjushri can or Samantabhadra in particular can really embody the quality of effort in just being able to bring some power to an activity, to be able to do something tirelessly, helps one to make vows to do things. Fifth paramita would be meditation or jhana, the ability to sit and concentrate and pay attention, which then can lead to, I think, the sixth paramita, which is wisdom or prajna, and, you know, the wisdom that is really able to see reality as it is, aside from our stories. You might have noticed that I did not mention compassion yet as a paramita, and compassion is actually not a paramita. You know, I think that, and I've never known why really that is, but I think that actually compassion is something that is brought about by engaging with these practices. You know, that we when I think about how to practice compassion, I'm not too sure, but I can you know, kind of quantify engaging in each of these practices a little bit more. And so I think these qualities are really, you know, ways to manifest compassion in our interactions with the world. I do want to mention a few more paramitas beyond the sort of the traditional six. One would be skillful means, or upaya, or tactfulness. You know, an example of that would be speaking to other people in a way that they can hear. You know, you can be as right as rain, and if you can't find a way to convey that to someone in a way that they're, you know, able to receptively hear, it really doesn't matter. So skillful means, I think, is a practice that we work with a lot in just in our daily lives. The eighth paramita would be vow or pranadana. And I'll get to this in a minute. At the end of all of this, we're going to be chanting actually the four bodhisattva vows. So vow is important in our practice, because vow is sometimes really what sustains us through times when, you know, it feels like things aren't going well, or we don't know what we're doing, or, you know, something's not working, or something feels hard or difficult. Vow, when making beneficial vows, I think, is a way to help us continue to bring our practice to the world. Two final ways of bringing our practice through the world would be powers, or bala, and knowledge, or jnana, which are actually ways in which we can guide our activity through knowledge of just, you know, any field of study that you've engaged in your life that you think might be something that you can bring beneficially to someone. That's jnana. And yeah, I never can say it right. Yeah. And powers would be abilities that you develop through meditation that will help to support that beneficial activity. So if you are, you know, able to maybe volunteer someplace, that's maybe partly coming out of things like powers or knowledge, some way to work with others to help support beings. So those are the paramitas. I said that there were two main things that guide bodhisattva actions, and the other main thing that guides bodhisattva actions would be the four integrative or inconceivable actions of bodhisattvas, which are giving, similar to dana paramita, kind speech, finding a way to talk to people kindly, even if what you have to say is, you know, something like constructive criticism, beneficial action and employing skills to help other people, and cooperation or non-opposition. So finding a way to help constructively, even if you're not wholly in favor of an action. And Dogen talks about seeking the right way without reward. When he talks about these four beneficial bodhisattva actions, he's really talking about helping others to find their way to join in to a positive action. And, you know, people, one of the things that Dogen talks about is people will always form a nation, and nations are, you know, in need of some kind of beneficial leader. And not saying that each of us is a beneficial leader, but I think, you know, maybe a goal is to find a way to participate in the action at hand in such a way that you can bring something beneficial to it. Even if we don't completely agree with an action that is going on around us with our group, is there a way that we can bring ourselves to that action in such a way that maybe we can influence it or improve it, or, you know, find a way to help things, you know, kind of turn themselves in the right direction? And so I think that cooperation is a hugely important aspect of bodhisattva practice. And I was trying to think of an example, and the thing that came to mind was a number of us here have, over the past couple of weeks, had the opportunity to join in a group that is chanting the Enmei Juku Kanon-gyo at the Joffrey Ballet as part of a performance that they're doing. And so we've gone, you know, we've had particular times that we've signed up to go, and you go and you you know, you join in, and it's really what makes it such a great example is we often chant the Enmei Juku Kanon-gyo here, you know, and we have a mokugyo, and, you know, we, one way or another, we start, we find our pitch, we kind of try to stay with the mokugyo, and sometimes, you know, sometimes it's a little slower, sometimes it's a little faster. And, you know, and we just do it. And what's, you know, similar but different about doing it with the Joffrey Ballet is that we don't get to decide when we're going to do it. There's a particular point in the music where we stand up and we have to chant. We don't get to decide what note or pitch we're all going to be on, because we all have to be on a particular pitch. We don't decide how fast it's going to be, because we have to follow the conductor. We don't decide when it's going to end, because the conductor has made that decision. But we cooperate, you know, and it brings you know, a wonderful quality to this piece by the and. None of us, you know, is a virtuoso. There's microphones, you know, trying to pick up all of us, and we all have to be as loud and as precise as we can be. And in doing that, we really very much make one voice, and that, I think, is one of the key aspects of bodhisattva activity in the world. That we, you know, on the one hand, we practice individually as bodhisattvas, but we're sustained by the fact that others are practicing around us, and that it's not a solo virtuoso performance. We're doing these things with others. And so that's where I think, you know, the idea of cooperation and beneficial action and kind speech are so important, because we can't do any of this without others. We, you know, bodhisattvas may make an individual vow to stay, you know, and you know, help everyone cross over before them, but it only works if everybody does it. You know, it's and everybody already is doing it, so it's okay. You know, it's going to work. So, you know, when we are at our best, we naturally employ these methods. You can probably already see examples of them in your life. And, you know, I think practice does help us all to increasingly apply them more often, more skillfully, more subtly, to the benefit of all beings. But you can only start right where you are in any minute. You know, some moments are going to be more challenging to practice, or to even figure out the way to practice. Other moments are going to feel, you know, easier and more natural to practice these. I wanted to close with one last reading from the Vietnamese teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, who there was an article published by Thich Nhat Hanh in Lion's Roar magazine last week. I think maybe partly having to do with Valentine's Day. It's about bringing compassion to your individual relationships. But he has a nice image that I want to bring into this conversation. So he says, when you begin to practice Buddhism, you begin as a part-time Buddha, and slowly you become a full-time Buddha. Sometimes you fall back and become a part-time Buddha again, but with steady practice, you become a full-time Buddha again. Buddhahood is within reach because, like the Buddha, you're a human being. You can become a Buddha whenever you like. The Buddha is available in the here and now, anytime, anywhere. When you are a part-time Buddha, your romantic relationships may go well some of the time. When you are a full-time Buddha, you can find a way to be present and happy in your relationship full-time, no matter what difficulties arise. And I think that we can find that through beneficial action, kind speech, giving, cooperation. But he goes on to say, becoming the Buddha is not so difficult. A Buddha is someone who is enlightened, capable of loving and forgiving. You know that at times you're like that. So enjoy being a Buddha. When you sit, allow the Buddha in you to sit. When you walk, allow the Buddha in you to walk. Enjoy your practice. If you don't become a Buddha, who will? So although he's saying Buddha, I think this very much applies to bodhisattvas and to all of our lives as bodhisattvas. There are times when, you know, we're at our best and we're really able to be, you know, kind, generous, cooperative beings in the world. And there are times when we have to work at it a little bit more. So, you know, that just is kind of where it is. And so that is, you know, the inconceivable aspect of how these ancient teachings relate to our life right now. They only live to the extent that we bring them. So it's inconceivable, but it can be done. So I think that's where I want to end, and I want to just open the conversation up for any kind of discussion anybody wants to have about that or anything else.
Thank you, Rishan. So comments, questions, responses, anyone, please feel free.
That was a great talk. Thank you so much. I want to say one thing about cooperation. It's one of my favorite things I learned through this practice is cooperation. And there will be an opportunity to do that today, right after this talk. And it's really a great thing to do. It's really the way I learned about cooperation in this practice, because we do housekeeping together. We do it in silent teams. And it's all laid out for us exactly what we need to do. And we become one as we go through the entire Zendo and kitchen and so forth. And it's a very physical, it's a practice that sort of takes all of you to do. And it's a really good example of cooperation.
Yeah, that is a great example.
I invite everyone to do that.
And the ways in which everybody has a different task.
Yes. Right, but there's not. It really does feel like becoming one if we do it well. I changed the way I clean my own house too. I don't have a team of bodhisattvas working with me. Two uncooperative cats.
Thanks.
Other questions or comments?
Or examples of bodhisattva activity that you've observed lately?
Thank you very much for that talk. It's it was also interesting to hear the distinction between Theravada and Soto Zen. So thinking about the bodhisattvas. But it made me think too, like before I was studying Buddhism, I was studying Taoism, and then Guanyin, you know, was, because I was working with a Chinese Tai Chi teacher, the bodhisattva, although we didn't call it bodhisattva, that we talked about quite a bit, and the power of trying to identify with that and with those qualities, and working to understand the aspects of the bodhisattva so that you can identify and maybe bring out some of those in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So it just reminded me of that. But yeah, it's like all of the bodhisattvas are interesting. We refer to them in different places, and they begin to run through, you know, so distinctly talking about them separately was helpful.
Thanks, yeah. I think it really is helpful to study each one and really get familiar with the different ways in which they manifest, and it makes it easier to start seeing it in life around you. Thanks.
Yes, Deborah.
Sandy Boucher is a Buddhist teacher in the San Francisco Bay Area, wrote a book about her practice during her cancer treatment. Mm-hmm. And she had no health insurance, so she was using that public hospital. Mm-hmm. And so she would often be on a gurney or sitting and waiting for hours for her treatments. And at one point, she decided to really look deeply and see the bodhisattvas around her, those who responded to her with kindness and care and sensitivity. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a moment of support for during her treatment to be able to consciously notice those who were supportive and caring of her.
That's a great example. And I think, you know, that is maybe another aspect of bodhisattva activity that I didn't quite say, which is when we receive it from others and we recognize that we've received it from others, you just feel so appreciative, you know? And it just makes you want to bring it to other people, you know, and find a way to do that. And so it comes out of, you know, that aspect of joy or relief, you know, that you just want everybody to feel that. So that's a wonderful example.
Yes,
just following up on that, and through a variety of circumstances over the last, you know, several years, handful of years, I've had opportunities to spend time in hospitals in different contexts, and on a number of occasions, several occasions, you know, I've been really struck by people in these very difficult circumstances, emergency rooms and so on, and some of them, you know, relatively doing relatively humble things, emptying the trash, and you know, as well as relatively sophisticated things, being doctors. And, you know, it's so noticeable that some people have made, like, a commitment to, of some kind, to take on being kind, being helpful, you know, even though there's nothing sort of in it for them or something. And I actually, you know, I actually stopped people a couple of times and said, what's up? What are you doing? And it's, I didn't meet anybody who said, well, I'm a Buddhist, and I think it's on. I said, well, I'm in this situation. You know, people are in terrible circumstances, and I just made a commitment to myself to make a commitment to all these people. And, you know, it's terribly moving, but what, I mean, I guess the point of that is that, I mean, I guess I just use the word commitment, but I guess I should use the word you use, which is vow. And it can be this intentional thing that we can take on, and it's not a matter of, like, doing it right, but staying with it, and, you know, as I think you use the term, bringing it, you know, which is, and I don't know, and I think, you know, I think we sometimes get this idea that if we just sit long enough, then, you know, something magic's going to happen to us, and then we'll be on. But we can't wait for that, you know, or we should, or we don't need to. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Thank you for your talk.
Thank you. You know, my husband talks about that with respect to marathons, because he was a marathoner for 20 years, and now he doesn't want to do it at all, doesn't want anything to do with it, and now I'm like the one who's taken up running, and I'm like, oh, this is so great, you know, how do you get to where you can run a marathon? I mean, I can't even imagine it. And he's like, you have to really want to, you know, like no matter what, it's gonna take more than you actually have to run a marathon. I mean, unless you're one of the, maybe if you're one of the, you know, super talented elite runners, but it made me realize that there are a lot of things in life that you have to really want to do them. You can't just say, oh, well, you know, I'll give that a try and see how it goes. Because you have to get through all that difficult, you know, the things that prevented you from doing it before you even thought about doing it. But that's a great example.
Thank you. Is there just time for one more comment or question or response, if anyone would like? Will.
Thanks. One question, just kind of going off that, just sort of going off what you said, you know, about you can't wait for it to happen. One way that I've kind of understood patience is that you do sort of wait for it to happen, kind of. And there seems to be something to, like, you know, you can't make enlightenment happen. Mm-hmm. You kind of have to just, like, sit and let it happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, like, what your reflections are on these practices of, like, the paramitas, for example, about making yourself generous versus letting yourself be generous, or...
Ah, that's a great distinction. And maybe somebody else will have something more profound to say about this than I do, or just different. But, you know, one of the things that we talk about with Zazen is the transformative power that it has over us, that we show up, you know, and we sit down and we make some kind of small vow to sit for the period and try to be present with whatever's happening. But what happens is that, you know, by setting up those conditions, it's really, you know, Zazen doing us. And I think maybe those particular practices are kind of the same way. You know, we kind of set ourselves up and say, okay, I'm going to give this a try, you know, make myself available for it, try to be present for as long as I've decided to do it. But you're right, we don't have control. We can't really bring ourselves forward to do these things. The kind of like Dogen says, you know, these myriad things have to come forth and bring us along with them, but also manifest through our activities. Does that address? Yeah. Maybe there's something more to say about that.
Well, there's always more to say, but Paul, did you want to say something?
I wanted to say briefly, going right back to the Bodhisattva ideal, that and the paramitas, that we have this idea of a Bodhisattva as someone who completely embodies compassion or completely embodies vow or whatever. But it's helpful to me to look at the most difficult people in my life that I can't get away from, whether they're co-workers or family members or whatever, as bodhisattvas as well. So if I have a family member who helps me realize the paramita of patience, that maybe they're a bodhisattva through their difficulty helping me realize that. And I only get patient because I don't have a choice. Because I can't, they're my family member. I have to stay connected to them somehow. So yeah. I just wanted to talk to, as far as paramitas getting developed, sometimes it's the most difficult people in our lives that are actually helping us develop those.
So to quote scripture in the Vimalakirti Sutra, it says that only a bodhisattva can hassle another bodhisattva. So we'll close with the four bodhisattva vows.